Let's Talk About is recorded and produced in Treaty 1 territories, on the original lands of the Anishinaabe, Cree, Oji-Cree, Dakota, and Dene peoples, and on the homeland of the Métis Nation. Thank you very much for listening. Welcome back to Let's Talk About, and this lined up perfectly. I did not plan it to be this way, but we are a week or less than a week away from the federal election. It's happening on September 20th. I know who I'm voting for, but who are you voting for? I hope you've decided. We're getting down to the wire. I watched the debates, and they were interesting, to say the least. But this lines up very perfectly because it is episode 3 of the Exploring the Charter series, and we've gone through the introduction to the Charter, we've gone through the guarantee of rights and freedoms, the reasonable limits clause, we've gone through the fundamental freedoms, and now we've arrived at the democratic rights. Now this. These rights here in the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms, I got it right here with me, have to do with the structure of governance and the application of democracy and the structure of democracy in Canada. So we actually have enshrined in our rights rules surrounding how the democracy of Canada functions at a more broad general level. The specificities of it are in the Canadian Criminal Code and our actual legal writs. So that structure is a little bit more complicated, and some of the rules around how the House and the Senate function are a little bit more complicated. But in our most fundamental document upon which the Canadian society is founded, as current, have to do with kind of the broad strokes of how the House of Commons functions and the elected Parliament of Canada functions. So it's sections 3, 4, and 5 of the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms, and it's under the heading of Democratic Rights. So, section 3, every citizen of Canada has the right to vote in an election of members of the House of Commons or of a legislative assembly and to be qualified for membership therein. Section 4, subsection 1, no House of Commons and no Legislative Assembly shall continue for longer than 5 years from the date fixed for the return of the writs at a general election of its members. Section 4, subsection 2, in time of real or apprehended war, invasion, or insurrection, a House of Commons may be continued by Parliament and a Legislative Assembly may be continued by the Legislature beyond 5 years if such continuation is not opposed by the votes of more than 2/3 of the members of the House of Commons or the Legislative Assembly, as the case may be. Section 5. There shall be a sitting of Parliament and of each Legislature at least once every 12 months. So, that last part in the rights is very self-explanatory. I didn't really need to think that I need to talk about it. It's kind of sad that it is that legally infrequent, but that's basically saying that as Canadians, it is our legal right to have our legislative assemblies, our provincial legislatures, and the federal House of Commons are legally obligated to meet at least once every year. I'm not kidding. That is Section 5 of the Charter of Rights and Freedoms. There shall be a sitting of Parliament and of each legislature at least once every 12 months. So during COVID, for all intents and purposes, suspending our legislature here in Manitoba and how infrequently the legislature met and how infrequently the Parliament of Canada met was legal. It's allowed. They can basically convene a Parliament on the last day of the year, on December 31st, and do a bunch of votes. Pass things if they want to. Actually, they would need to have three votes in three meetings to pass anything. So they could, like, meet on December 31st and have one single sitting of the Parliament and one single sitting of the legislature, and they have met their legal obligations to Canadians. That's ridiculous. Like, it should be... I mean, obviously they need to plan for vacations and when Parliament is out of session and the legislature is out of session for summer and for Christmas and things like that, the Parliament and the legislatures don't sit year round. They aren't sitting, like, they don't go to work 9 to 5, 5 days a week like we do. But yeah, that's the amount of legality of Parliament and the provincial legislatures. They only have to meet once a year legally. Which is kind of crazy to think about. I really wish it was a little bit more frequently than that, or the rule was a little bit more flexible than that. But here we are. The important one, really, is Section 3 of the Canadian Charter of Rights. Every citizen of Canada has the right to vote in an election of members of the House of Commons or of a legislative assembly, and to be qualified for membership therein. So that essentially is what gives every Canadian the right to vote. Every Canadian gives us the right to vote in the country, in the federal elections, and the provincial legislature of your residence. So I can vote in Manitoba elections. I can't vote in, like, Saskatchewan elections because I don't have a Saskatchewan address. I don't have an Ontario address. I'm not a part of a riding anywhere outside of Manitoba. So I can only vote in Manitoba elections, and I can vote in Canadian elections. Now, we know from Section 1 of the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms that the Reasonable Limits Clause comes in here, because there are Canadian citizens who are not allowed to vote. And that is because they have committed certain capital crimes, certain crimes from which they have been convicted and have possibly spent their time in prison. And they are disenfranchised. In the U.S. it's called felony disenfranchisement, where you commit a felony and you lose your right to vote. So this is that limitation on your right to vote, is if you have committed certain crimes, you lose your right to vote. And that was where it's part of, you know, such reasonable limits prescribed by law as can be demonstrably justified in a free and democratic society. It is written into Canadian law that you can lose your right to vote. And that is extremely important because it has implications for certain crimes and criminals. So there are definitely people out there who you probably don't want voting. You probably don't want people who've committed treason to vote. You probably don't want people who have, you know, committed fraud in elections to vote. You probably don't want people that committed fraud to vote at all. But there are people that commit crimes and that are able to vote. They do not lose that right. It's just in certain circumstances you can lose your right to vote because of the legality of Canada. So it's because it's justified. It's reasonable and justified in a democratic society that some people lose their right to vote. Now, what this does is it excludes people who have committed certain crimes. The great example is the what happens to people with drug convictions. They lose certain key functions in society. They lose certain key abilities in society that they really don't have a vehicle to get back very effectively. You see this very strongly in the United States, where you have felony disenfranchisement. So people who get convicted of drug crimes, which are felony crimes in the United States, you know, things like marijuana being legal in Canada, those are exclusionary. Those can get your right to vote taken away. So these people go and they go to prison for a couple of years and they come out and they have lost the ability to vote. They have lost their voice in democracy. They've lost their right to work and to be a member of a democracy. Even though they live in this country, in that country, they are subject to its laws, they're subject to its taxation, you know, that whole taxation without representation thing. We get taxed, and those taxes pay for the government that we elect. We elect that government to function, and we agree that the government shall be functioning, and we agree to have our tax money go towards that. So certain people in Canadian society have lost that ability. And notice how it says Canadian citizens. And this is where we get to a very important distinction on who has the right to vote in this country. It is Canadian citizens only. I'm a Canadian citizen because I was born here. I was born and raised here. My mom was not born here. She was born in, I mean, another Commonwealth nation. She was born in the UK and she moved to Canada when she was younger. She gained her citizenship. You know, she took the, you know, they did the whole citizenship rigmarole. People do that all the time. Like my grandparents, they took the citizenship test and passed it and were officially recognized as Canadian citizens. But there are people, Canadian nationals, there are Canadian people living in Canada. There are people who reside in Canada. That Canada is, they have a Canadian passport. They, you know, have an address, they have a social insurance number, they have all of these this documentation that says they live here. They pay taxes here. They are, for all intents and purposes, part of Canadian society, but they have not fulfilled that requirement of being a full Canadian citizen, so they do not have the right to vote. Because it is not outlined in the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms that they can vote, which is very, very interesting. So, what does it take to actually become a Canadian citizen? And we're being confronted by this right now because there's been an ongoing refugee crisis for probably about a decade now. People from war-torn Middle Eastern countries are coming here, war-torn African countries are coming here to live a better life and to have a life that is safer for their families. I know people who have immigrated to Canada and some people who are not yet citizens. So, what does it take to become a citizen? Well, you have to be a permanent resident. So you have a permanent residence. You have achieved that status in Canada. You have lived in Canada for 3 out of the last 5 years. Have filed your taxes if you need to. Pass a test on your rights, responsibilities, and knowledge of Canada, and prove your language skills. So you have to be fluent enough in one of Canada's official languages to communicate effectively and operate effectively in Canadian society. You need to pay your taxes if you, 'cause to be a permanent resident, you will be paying taxes or have to pay taxes to be a permanent resident. And being a permanent resident means you will probably have to have lived 3 of the last 5 years in this country. You can live a year away from the country and come back for work or for personal reasons, but you need to be a permanent resident who has lived in Canada 3 out of the past 5 years. Then you take the citizenship test, which tests your knowledge of your rights, your responsibilities as a Canadian, and your knowledge of Canada, and then you move from a permanent resident status to a Canadian citizen status. So there are, underneath Canadian citizenship, there are three other specific categories. There's the permanent resident, the temporary resident, and the protected person. The protected person is basically a refugee. It's a person who is living in Canada and staying in Canada because they cannot go home. It's unsafe for them to go home for political reasons, for religious reasons, for whatever. There are temporary residents who are people with a visa, a specific, any type of visa to live in Canada, and then there is a permanent resident. It's a person who lives in, so you can be sponsored to become a permanent resident, and that is the next step towards becoming a citizen. It's actually very interesting. People talk about, marrying into Canada when Donald Trump was elected. And when the last American election was going on, a lot of people talked about, oh, well, I'll just marry a Canadian and move to Canada and become Canadian. That's not exactly how it works in Canada. You still can marry somebody and move to Canada, but you will be a temporary resident of Canada. You will need to get a visa to come here and stay here, and then your spouse can sponsor you to become a permanent resident. That means you have the legal right to reside in Canada permanently. We can't, CBSA can't rock up to your house, grab you, and take you to the airport. They can't kick you out of the country because you are a permanent resident. But you are not yet a citizen. You can be sponsored to become a. You pay money and do certain, fill up certain paperwork to sponsor somebody to become a permanent resident. And then you have to follow those criteria, those other criteria, living in Canada 3 out of the last 5 years, filing your taxes, passing the citizenship test, and proving your language skills. You still have to pass those, that basically pass that bar to become a Canadian citizen, and that gives you all of the rights that I've been talking about in this series so far, including the right to vote, which is very clearly marked out for Canadian citizens only. Now, Section 4, with two subsections, has to do with how long parliaments and legislatures sit, and the one real exemption that it has to extend past that period, and basically to ensure the functioning of the government. So basically, what subsection 1 says, no House of Commons and no Legislative Assembly shall continue for longer than 5 years from the date fixed for the return of the writs at a general election of its members. So the writs of election are what set the date of when an election is. So they are signed and written down. This is when the next election will be called. There's been laws passed since the writing of the Charter of Rights and Freedoms, which fixes that date 4 years from the last election. It'll be a little bit wiggly after this election because it's a year and a bit into Justin Trudeau's second term as Prime Minister. By the way, there are no term limits for prime ministers in Canada. You can ser There have been prime ministers that have served multiple decades, like 20 years plus, as prime minister unbroken in Canada. Hasn't happened very recently. Stephen Harper was around a decade as prime minister, but that was through a whole bunch of a different rigmarole. But basically, subsection 1 of section 4 of the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms basically says, you can't have a parliament and legislature that lasts more than 5 years. You can't. You legally cannot. It is enshrined in law. You can't, a parliament cannot just continue going. A legislature, Brian Pallister or Jason Kenney or Jim Horgan or Doug Ford, they can't just say this legislature is going to keep going. They can get up, they have up to 5 years, and that's when the writ of elections kick in, and you have another provincial election. Same thing, Justin Trudeau can't just say this parliament's going to continue on. He can't just go to the governor general and say, hey, you're not going to dissolve parliament for an election. Because it's subsection, you could possibly extend it past the 4 year mark in which it's the actual legal standing in Canada that an election, a federal election, happens every 4 years. But it can't go past that because it is one of our fundamental rights as Canadians that no parliament shall last more than 5 years. So this is basically a protection against dictatorship and basically illegal or the violation of our democratic rights. That's why this section is called the Democratic Rights. Section 4, subsection 1 preserves the functioning of the democracy because it sets a hard limit on how long a parliament and legislature can exist for before it is automatically dissolved ahead of the next election. Now, subsection 2 also has to do with the maintenance of our democratic rights, and that's to preserve our democratic rights in times of war. So just to read it again, Section 4, subsection 2, in time of real or apprehended war, invasion, or insurrection, House of Commons may be continued by Parliament, and a legislative assembly may be continued by the legislature beyond 5 years, if such continuation is not opposed by the votes of more than one-third of the members of the House of Commons or the legislative assembly, as the case may be. So this has happened a few times. You know, World War I, World War II are kind of the situations where this would have happened because those wars lasted more than 10 years. Or lasted more than 5 years, sorry. I don't know why I'm thinking 10 years. Harper was on the brain because I was going to talk about the war in Afghanistan next. But because Canada had officially declared war in those two circumstances, in World War I and World War II, and I want to make sure I get the actual number right. not opposed by votes of more than one-third of the members. So you basically need a majority. Not a simple majority. A simple majority is 50% down the middle. A majority in Parliament is two-thirds. You need a two-thirds majority to continue a Parliament or a legislature beyond the 5-year limit as prescribed in section 4 subsection 1. So what this does is it allows for, in times of crisis where you need an individual to step in and a leader for the country and have the continuity of leadership and structure that is required in times of conflict when, you know, things are a little bit dicey, it's very important that things continue on, you know, because what happens when, and we're seeing it right now because of the snap election that's been called. When an election is called, everything shuts down. The government just shuts down. I have a friend of mine who works for an MP. He works on Parliament Hill, and he's not doing, like, they're in campaign mode. The MP's not doing his job right now because he is running for re-election. He's doing everything he can to continue on to be elected again. So no parliamentary work is ongoing. No Senate work is ongoing. No, and when there's a provincial election, no legislative work is ongoing. And that has serious implications. So there are parts of the government that continue on. Obviously, there are crown corporations. They don't just stop working. But you don't have ministers at the heads of a lot of the big departments. And you don't have somebody to head up the Canadian military. You do not have a minister of defense during an election because that minister is fighting to be re-elected so they can then again be appointed to be minister of defense. And usually it's a few months. Like, it's not as quick as the snap election, like literally snap election, where it happened in a month. It is a lot more complicated than that because it's a multi-month process. And when you're in a war like World War I or World War II, where you need solid leadership and you need the continuity of the chain of command and you need the continuity of Parliament, that needs to be extended and continue on so there's no interruption there. Also, what could happen is you could have an election and the prime minister who is leading the country is defeated, a new prime minister comes in, and suddenly they want to pull out of the war. Parliament has the ability to declare war. And that is, they also have the power to pull out from a war that is ongoing. So what could happen, and what this is protecting against, is in a time of conflict, if there's an insurrection going on, if there's civil war in Canada, if Canada's part of a massive conflict overseas or within our own borders, and suddenly we have this election and the chain of command stops more or less, and the military is still going to continue to function, but the policy directives from the top are going to stop, And then you have the election, you bring in a new government, and suddenly the new prime minister and the new, you know, you flip a bunch of seats, you get the third that you need, you know, you get the majority that you need to call off the war and rescind that declaration of war, and suddenly Canada's military is in a really tough spot, and our allies are in a really tough spot because there's nobody to defend Canada. Like, imagine if it's the War of 1812 and the Americans are burning down Parliament, and suddenly we have a snap election, and you know, the fate of Canada is hanging in the balance, because if a certain person wins this election, they're just going to end it all, say, whatever, we're done, we're going to give up to the Americans, and we are a part of America now. That is a full-on possibility. So what this right does, what Section 4, Subsection 2 does, is it gives a mechanism and it gives Canadians a right to have a consistent government throughout times of conflict. It gives us legal protections from having somebody who will work against the interests of Canada. So say, you know, it's roll back to World War II. Prime Minister at the time of Canada was William Lyon Mackenzie King. William Lyon Mackenzie King was Prime Minister three separate times. He was Prime Minister 1921 to 1926, 1926 to 1930, and 1935 to 1948. So he was the Prime Minister of Canada during World War II. If Mackenzie King had lost that election, and suddenly his successor comes in and ends that war, that pulls Canada out of the Second World War and essentially allies ourselves against the British and the Americans and puts us on the side of Nazi Germany. And I don't know many Canadians who would have been happy with that decision. So really, William Lyon Mackenzie King was Prime Minister for 13 years. And that was part of, basically, he was Prime Minister from 1921 until 1930, he wasn't Prime Minister for 5 years, and then he was Prime Minister again for 13 years, right after that. And he had gotten Canada coming out of the First World War and got us through the Second World War, and without an extension, without the legal right of Canada of Canadian citizens to have a majority, a parliamentary majority, to continue on that parliament, we would have had an election, and we would have potentially gotten a new prime minister who would have opposed that war and put Canada and Canadians at risk, and put the will of Canadians at risk. Because remember, your MPs are there to represent you. So those two-thirds that say this parliament continues on are representing Canadians and saying, we want this war to continue on. We want to ensure the continuity of leadership within this war. So that is what that section. So section 4, section 3 has to do with giving every Canadian citizen the right to vote and enshrining that in law as a basic right of Canadians. Section 4 has to do with continuity of governance and ensuring that the democracy is maintained at all times and cannot be abused, so parliaments can only last 5 years. And during times of conflict, the parliament can be continued to continue the continuity of leadership. So that's the maintenance of democracy. And then subsection 5, very, very simply, section 5, the parliament and legislatures have to sit at least once in 6 years, or once every 12 months. So that's just ensuring that the parliament does its job, more or less. So that is those are the democratic rights of Canadians in the Charter of Rights and Freedoms. So next week, we will be, the day after the election, we will be getting into mobility rights, which are very interesting and which are a hot-button issue right now. But until then, thank you very, very much for listening. I have been Jason, you have been the audience. This has been Let's Talk About It. If you're listening live on 101.5 UMFM, keep that dial at 101.5. Got great songs, great shows coming up right after this one. If you're listening to Spotify, thank you very much for your download. And as always, have yourselves a wonderful, wonderful week.